Welcome, listeners, to another episode of Listen, Learn, and Love. This episode is hosted by my guest host and friend, Tanya Miller. Tanya Miller is a licensed clinical social worker, active Latter-day Saint, and married mother of four. Tanya Miller was on episode 501, where she spoke about healing from church-generated trauma, an episode, according to SoundCloud, with over 60,000 listens. Tanya is also the author of a chapter addressing the same topic in my third book, Listen, Learn, and Love, Building the Good Ship Zion. I trust Tanya because of her level of maturity and extensive clinical experience to be an excellent guest host. As I mentioned in my solo episode, episode 731, my emotional gas tank is low, and I've decided to cut back and generally host only LGBTQ-focused episodes. I knew that meant there were other brave stories from amazing people, the real heroes of this podcast, that might not be shared, and was sad about that. However, Tanya and I reconnected shortly after I posted that episode and explored the possibility of having her guest host, so these stories could still be shared and delivered on this platform. And I'm really grateful to have Tanya as a guest host.
Hello, listeners, and thank you, Richard. I feel very humble about this undertaking, and I am so grateful for your trust. I don't take that lightly, especially the trust that every courageous guest offers when they participate in this process. I am so hopeful that the good work accomplished already by Listen, Learn, and Love will continue to expand, and that the gentle spirit that has always accompanied Richard's podcast can be maintained.
Listeners, tonight I am with Stacy Proctor. Stacy is an active LDS mother of one. She's married to her husband, Andy, who was featured on an earlier podcast. Stacy is also the founder and CEO of Gathered. She was recently recognized as one of Utah Business 40 Under 40 for her leadership and contributions in business. She's also serving currently as Mrs. Vineyard and will compete in the Mrs. Utah pageant in March this year. In that role, she works with leadership across politics, religion, and business to help restore community and connection. Stacy loves to travel. She and her husband recently made s'mores on a volcano in Iceland, which put that on my list, the bucket list now. Stacy, welcome. We're so looking forward to hearing your story. Listeners, Stacy is going to share some details about the pathway that led her to peace after enduring some incredibly difficult challenges with mental health. I am so grateful for Stacy's courage and not only to share in this format her story. I know it will help so many people. As a therapist myself, I just applaud everyone who walks through that space, which can be so frightening and isolating. It's an incredibly heroic journey that anyone takes. So, Stacy, let's hand things over to you.
Great. Thank you, Tanya.
What did I miss? Anything that you want to add to the introduction?
No, I think that was great.
Okay. Well, yeah. Welcome. I am so looking forward to hearing you tell your story.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for having me. I've been a longtime fan of Papa Osler, so I'm really grateful.
The best.
To be invited to share my story here. And like you said, my hope is that, and anyone hearing this, that they'll be able to find themselves in the story and maybe even just know what's the one next step that they need to take, or have a moment of hope if they're feeling despair, or a moment of peace and just trusting that God has them in his care.
I love that. Thank you. And it's sure a lot easier to do that with that reassurance. We are in his care. Yeah. Thank you. All right.
Well, I will jump into my story. Yes. To give a little life history. This is, we'll start there. Just to give a little bit of context. So I was raised in the church. My parents divorced early on. I was about 18 months old. We moved quite a bit and had a lot of change happening all throughout my early life. There was a history of mental illness in my family. And so there were a lot of really hard things that I experienced growing up, but also there was a lot of good too at the same time. One of the best things that happened in all of that transition, all of the moving and change, was that no matter where we moved to, we had a built-in community with the church. I've lived across the country and and everywhere, you know, we went, we were taken in to these communities. And one of the lessons that I learned from that was that the vast majority of people in this world are good.
Yes.
We always had a place to stay. We always had food to eat. And we always had friends everywhere that we went.
I
really attribute that to the organization of the church. Overall, I would say that my faith and religious community enriched my life. And it was really only as an adult, though, that it became essential. So I've been married to my husband, Andy, for almost 11 years. And we do have a toddler named Will, who's made of sunlight. And
I love that description.
Really, really grateful for both of them. And before meeting Andy, I had been married for 2 years. And during the heartbreak of that relationship, I turned to God and found comfort, compassion, guidance, and hope. And really, God became my friend.
Listeners, thank
and
you for
somebody
joining
that
us
I could trust of Listen, and Learn, and rely on. I also had a lot of faith that even though some of the earlier parts of my life had felt really broken, I believed that God could make me whole and could help me have joy. So I'll share a little bit more.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you.
Okay. It was about a year into our marriage when I started struggling with depression. Andy and I had been trying to get pregnant for about 14 months and hadn't been able to. And so I thought that maybe it was because I was working and I needed to come home and then God would bless me with a baby. And that ended up not being a good decision for me with my mental health. It really broke down my sense of purpose and direction. A few other things happened at that same time. One was that I had a major surgery and was in a lot of physical pain, which anyone who's been through that knows that can just be really emotionally wearing as well. And then to kind of top it all off, my uncle passed away by suicide.
Oh,
and so that was really devastating. And I just felt like I was buried deeper in grief than I could pull myself out of. And I did try to pull myself out, just with positive thinking and creating meaningful experiences. Andy and I even traveled back to some of my places I had grown up and to try to reconnect to this happier time and in my life and happier version of myself. And nothing was working. And in fact, it just seemed like it was getting worse. So one of the things that I tried was I heard from a friend about this self-help workshop in Florida and felt like I really want to go to this and see if this can help me kind of snap out of it. While I was there, we were doing a lot of different exercises. And one of the exercises in particular was a dissociative meditation, which meditation can be a really wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Also, I've learned that there are different types of meditation and different types of brains, and we need to be really conscious that there are some who are at risk. And I was one of those people who was at risk for certain types of treatments. And when I was in the midst of one of these meditations, it felt like a hot egg cracked over my head. Mm. And I suddenly became, you know, really emotional and just kind of disoriented. The best way that I can talk about the next part is I usually ask people, have you ever seen the movie A Beautiful Mind?
And yes, and the book too. The book
Amazing. You read the book.
Yeah.
So you have even more details. So for anyone listening who has not seen the movie A Beautiful Mind, I want to give a fair warning that this is a spoiler. So to share a little bit about the story, it's a story of John Nash, who's a brilliant mathematician. And while in college, he makes this incredible mathematical discovery and he is set for life. He marries the girl of his dreams. And as life is going on, he is approached by a government agent who asks him secretly for help in breaking Soviet code. And so John utilizes his talents and skills with code breaking and numbers to try to help in this effort. And you get to watch as he's on this really thrilling journey. At times his life is in jeopardy and there's so much at stake. And you're just right there with him in it when suddenly you realize at a very pivotal moment that none of it's real.
Right. Yeah.
The code breaking, his role in protecting Americans, all of these significant things that are happening, none of it is real. And it is all in his mind.
He believes it. For him, it feels very real. Yes.
Yes. For him, it's very real.
Yeah.
And I love that depiction because it's the closest thing that I've found to describe what it felt like for me as I had a very similar experience, but with spiritual themes and in a much shorter period of time than I think his episode went on for. So it was just over the course of a few days that this all happened. But while I was in Florida at that workshop, felt the kind of egg crack over my head. And there was a deterioration in my sense of reality. And I experienced a lot of things that many of us in the church, for lack of a better word, aspire to.
Mm.
The things that we believe if we are righteous enough, if we are holy enough, pure enough, that these are the things that can happen. And so I spoke face to face with angels and with Christ. I was called on a mission to serve alongside the three Nephites. I was given the keys of creation. I was directed to follow the steps of the temple ceremony. And when I got to the end, I fully expected to enter God's presence on the other side of a doorway.
Yeah.
I was asked to sacrifice my life three times. And I was completely willing to do that. But every time at the last moment, I was rescued by a ram in the thicket.
Mm, yeah.
I had this sense of, you know, I know that these things are not the norm, but I just need to have faith. I need to have perfect faith, nothing wavering. And I need to be in complete integrity down to the precise amount of liquids in my carry-on bag for the flight home.
Yeah.
And after I got home, I fasted to purify myself, to prepare myself. And I awaited a call from the prophet.
Yeah.
And waited until I would be able to pass through the veil. and enter heaven.
Listeners, just to kind of describe from a clinical perspective, what Stacy was going through was that's psychosis, right? And the religious themes are often they can feel like a very profound experience for those who are experiencing these symptoms. And so it just the come down often from the psychosis is what I'm told is the hardest part that is disorienting, but also exciting as these features can be. It's down the road, and I think you're going to talk about that. But I just want to applaud you again for your courage in sharing the details about this, because you're being really vulnerable, and I know that's not easy. So thank you.
Thank you.
Continue.
So I was home at this point, and Andy, my husband, was aware that something was off. So he decided to take me to BYU to one of his former psychology professors and just get his opinion. And this was, you know, something that he'd never seen before. And just want to add that while I was in Florida, and I called Andy at one point and I told him about some of these incredible things that were happening, and he believed me. And he said later, he was like, well, if anyone was going to see Jesus, it's you. Like, you know, just that's how he saw me. And he believed that that was possible. And so I know that it was very, you know, it was very challenging for him as well to come to this point of realizing something's off here. And he's been on
Listen,
his own journey. We can cut that part out.
Okay, go ahead.
And he's been on his own journey, which he's spoken about on a former episode of the podcast. And just wanting to acknowledge that for a family member, this can also be a really challenging experience to be a part of.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So he took me to BYU, and I got to chat with his professor. Actually, we'll cut that part.
Sure. So okay.
He took me to BYU, and while I was there, I completely collapsed. I hadn't been eating. I hadn't been sleeping, drinking. And I was carried by an ambulance to the hospital, which I believed was spirit prison. And
yeah,
while I was there, another layer of the delusion or experience was that I believed that I was the bride of Christ, which I understand now is actually a pretty common theme for those who experience psychosis with religious themes. That's a pretty common one. So from that space, I was singing and dancing, and I believed I was in spirit prison. So I raised my arm and I demanded to be released, and I got a big shot of Zyprexa in the bum cheek.
Yes.
Which is the medicine that they used to help bring me out of that delusion. Yeah. So from there, at this point, the chemistry, you know, is starting to change, and there's a part of me that is starting to come back and be grounded in reality. And yet some of these things that I'd experienced were within the realms of my former reality. And so I really came to this point of choice where I could go on believing that all of the things that I was experiencing were real, and that this was just yet another trial of my faith, and I just needed to keep believing and keep going. Or I could accept the very real possibility that none of this was true. And I actually was in the hospital, and I actually had a mental breakdown. And I remember being really sad because it felt like I was letting God down in choosing to come back to reality. And underneath that too, I felt more broken and more insignificant than I ever had in my entire life. Mm-hmm. And like you said, that the experience of psychosis was not actually that bad for me, especially the singing and dancing. It was the aftermath that was the really hard part.
Yeah. When I've worked with individuals who are diagnosed with schizophrenia, they are quick to say, you know, it's the depression that is so, so painful and difficult to deal with day to day.
Yeah.
And, you know, we really do, I think, make choices again and again over whether we're going to essentially grieve, right? Grieve our losses, even if they are ones that others did not experience, right? Mm-hmm. Or kind of also I hide or almost choose shame, right? And, you know, grief, it delivers us to reality, essentially. It's how we learn to tolerate reality again after there's been changes. And so I would imagine there's a fair amount of kind of ambiguous grief that you, on top of everything else at that point, needed to kind of integrate and process.
Oh, yeah. And that's been a decade now, almost a decade.
Yeah.
Of a process. Yes. So I was diagnosed with bipolar 1 and I had had an episode of psychosis.
And real quick, for listeners that might not be well versed in like the DSM, bipolar 1, you may have heard it referred to as manic depressive disorder. That used to be what it was called. Essentially those with bipolar 1 disorder experience manic episodes, which is what Stacy was describing, and those can have features of psychosis, and then profound depressive symptoms as well. And it is it takes a lot of courage to live life with this kind of constellation of both. It's like strengths and challenges all just kind of wrapped up into one. And the fear is, if I want to mitigate the challenges, am I going to lose the strengths? Am I going to lose the other stuff? And it's a, I think, really misunderstood, diagnosis in that way. So,
From there, the doctor recommended medication as the treatment, and also specifically recommended that we consider not having children, just because there can be some complications with being on medication, conceiving, or coming off of the medication when trying to conceive, and how that can impact my own mental stability. And so really, the diagnosis felt in many ways like a death sentence, just of any sense of hope or future that could possibly be desired. So I came home from the hospital. I was in the hospital for about 9 days. And when I came home, I was as fragile as a baby bird and so disoriented. I did not know what was real. I didn't even know if I was real. And I was also experiencing constant intrusive suicidal thoughts. It was, the best way to describe it is like a swarm of gnats just constantly flying in. Mm. And time after time after time, I would try to redirect those thoughts. And it felt like it was taking all of my conscious attention and energy just to do that.
Yeah, so exhausting. Yeah.
I also had lost some basic motor functioning. I could not drive. Driving, being in the car felt like zooming 1,000 miles an hour. It just felt like a sensory overload. And we had actually just been packed up before all of this happened to move. And so we moved and were hanging pictures on the wall. And I remember I could not hang a picture on the wall straight, try as I might, adjusting it this way and that way. I just couldn't line it up. And as a really functioning person, that was really difficult.
And
with all of that, as you mentioned, was depression. And that depression felt like there was no floor. It just kept, I kept falling and falling, and it just kept going. And I think the worst part of it was that I felt truly alone at this time. Even with Andy being there to take care of me, I felt like a burden. I felt like the one person I would turn to would be God, but that God was not safe for me.
Right.
And my safe places, like the temple or reading scriptures, even praying, were extremely anxiety producing for me at that time. And I had developed aversions. I didn't realize it right off the bat until in therapy, but had some post-traumatic response to these things that had come up in my delusions. So when I sat at church, it felt like my head was on fire. And I needed so much therapy. And it felt like it would have been easier to try to put together an entire universe. And the other really challenging thing was I didn't trust myself anymore. I didn't know who to trust, and I didn't know where God was in any or all of this. And so it was really probably a couple of years later. My response at that time had been to keep doing all of the things and just to work through it. And I remember doing some exposure therapy where today I'm going to drive by the temple and I'm just going to sit with the feelings that I have in driving by. And then another day, I'm going to sit and park in front of the temple. And, you know, it's just taking it step by step and trying to reclaim these pieces, or at least neutralize them, so that I wasn't walking in constant threat mode. During that time, I leaned heavily on the former confidence that I had had and the beliefs that I'd had. I knew the vernacular. I knew what things to do, and just believed if I just keep doing these things, I'll break through this invisible wall that I was experiencing, because I felt disconnected and numb to all of these positive spiritual things. And so I just kept going and kept trying to find the good. And one of the things, so it was a couple of years after this happened that Andy and I had moved to California. And to be honest, a part of that was because the culture was a little bit too thick here in Utah for the state that
so
I was in.
You'd been living in Utah during this time. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And so we moved to California, and I was serving as a young women's leader in a ward and learning about family history just so that I could help teach about family history, and had this really beautiful experience where I suddenly found something that felt real and unquestionable in my mind, which was that I am part of this family, and this connection by the very fact that I exist, and I was born to my mother who was born to someone else, and there's this unbroken chain within our human family. I found myself in that, and I found a sense of grounding and a reality that I could start to really build on. And the interesting thing is, at that point, when I look now at my beliefs, I would say it was more in the realm of atheism, of just like, I want to believe, but I can't.
Yeah.
I just can't believe. And that in that space is where I found this connection and this love for our human family. Yeah. And it transcended race, religion, sexual orientation, like any previous other that I'd held, even as a really kind person. That just broke down. And I felt so inspired by the fact of our existence. And if you're familiar with Pale Blue Dot, you know, we are literally this magnificent, tiny miracle in the vastness of space. And with that, it just gave me this deep value and appreciation for my own life and for the relatively few billions of other people on the planet, and just the sense of connection. So I share that because that was one of the key moments in my healing, was coming to that place of connection.
I love that.
Another moment that was key was I was with a group of friends at a dinner, just new friends. And one of the friends, who is a gay member of the church, and I am so grateful for that, because he gets nuance and he gets the ambiguity. He told me about how he navigated his own path and journey, and that for him, in this place of confusion, that he came back to this guiding principle, which for him was, go towards that which feels like light.
Mm, I love that.
And it's a very vulnerable thing to do, to hold that compass inside rather than having someone outside of you tell you what to do, but to be quiet and listen and trust yourself and your sense of light. But I felt comfortable enough to share my experience with him, and that was one of those pivotal moments for me, and gave me this huge appreciation for others who walk a very nuanced path.
Yeah. I was just gonna just kind of add in there. I love that concept of go towards that which I think you said feels like light. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, each of us has, it comes down to our personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And does not really matter what the optics are on the outside. It is what's operating inside of us, and only we can recognize what will be light that is specific for us. I think that's really powerful. Thank you.
I love that. And it was not long after that conversation that it was a Sunday, and it was the very first time that I didn't go to church, and I was scared. I thought, is this the beginning of the end? And the crazy thing that's not so crazy now, but it was crazy at the time, is that sometimes taking a step that varies from the norm is actually what you personally need to do. And I've found that in multiple cases. And it was that thing, which was that day, I felt like getting quiet with myself was what I needed. And I found this video online. It was Wisdom from the Ancient World. And I have to tell you, I used to be terrified of ideas from other religions because I thought, oh, this is part of that flaxen cord that's going to lead me slowly, carefully away to my destruction. And, you know, the philosophies of men mingled with scripture, and I just had fear. And so this was a stretch for me, but I felt drawn to watch this thing. And amazingly, it was the first time that I felt the spirit in a long time. This was probably at least 5 years into the journey, 4.5 to 5 years. Mm. And I was surprised by that. I was surprised that that is where I found God. Mm. And I've learned that there are many pathways that lead to God. And with that, it gives me a lot more openness to other people's journeys and even to my own journey of just trying to think of the best way to say this. A non-judgment mm-hmm. about people's pathways.
Yeah. Yeah. When you said, you know, is this the beginning of the end? And the thought that came to my mind was, I hope it's the beginning of the end of making decisions based on shame, because mm-hmm. shame is, you know, the adversary's greatest tool. And it interferes so much with our ability to, I think, be found right by God. When you say, you know, you found God in the, was it a video? He found you, like, you know, that's how I think of it, is he comes, yeah. He comes wherever we can let him in. And shame is such a barrier to that. And it makes so much sense to me, given the, just the, how vast your, honestly, suffering had been. I mean, 5 years is a long time to wander in the wilderness, right? And yeah. And just how gently and quietly that reach comes. And I love also what you were saying about to stop, to pause, to just be. I have a friend who is she's an ancient scripture kind of divinity college, one of those smart people. And she was teaching me about the word Shabbat, and it means literally to stop. Mm. And I think, what a beautiful practice. And so I appreciate what you said about that.
Yeah, that is so beautiful. And there truly are these beautiful, magical elements of faith, of my faith, that I'm finding in different places that have been unexpected. And I'm starting to think God has a sense of humor, but also that God is really cool and definitely not as square as I thought.
I like that. Yeah. Yeah. I like too what you had said about the, I think you had said it, step-by-step reclaiming pieces. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you definitely accomplished that in terms of reclaiming the pieces of yourself so that you could function again, right? Which is no easy task, right? Mm-hmm. And then maybe at this point, maybe some hope that step by step, there might be a reclamation of safe connection with God.
Yes. Yeah, I really love how you phrased that. It was step by step. It is step by step.
Yeah.
It is a continuing journey. And I will say it has been a slow and often lonely road, but it is becoming less lonely as I go and find friends who also have had their own experiences. And when you are together and you share those, you see each other, you know each other, and you find we're not alone. There's actually a lot of us, and it's really great to be together. And I want to share too, I have a very maybe unique and fortunate experience with bipolar 1 in that I have largely been stable since mm-hmm. that episode. I have not relapsed. I have not gone back into that. And even the traditional kind of view of bipolar, of the day-to-day life even, are these ups and
sure,
these downs. That's
cycling.
Actually not
yeah.
my experience with yeah. it. And I think that has a lot to do with nutritional choices, sleep choices. I take a lot of supplements. Mm. I've really dug into what are the pillars of my mental health and well-being, and I'm really fortunate that I am stable in that way. And I know that that's not everyone's experience. And I know that it can be really challenging just to live yeah. each day with yeah. that.
You know, when I talk to clients about something, you know, diagnoses, essentially, I like to differentiate between a label and a name. When we label something, which would be bipolar 1, would be a label, right? Really, all it does is simplify communication, right? Essentially, you can say that and I will know what it means in terms of diagnostic criteria, right? It doesn't define anyone. It just, you know, it abbreviates the need to go and read lots of books about it, essentially. Naming something honors it. And so, you know, if you know one person who's dealing with depression, you know one person who's dealing with depression. And although there's similarities, obviously, one thing that both I think separates and then ultimately unites around those names is that what you call the slow and often lonely road. That is where we find Christ. It is a one-on-one experience, and I often wonder if the great equalizer is trauma in whatever way it shows up in our lives, and maybe it has a label, right? But regardless, when we name trauma, we are then in a place to begin to heal around it, and that is can be just such a beautiful, profound, at times lonely, but then connecting experience. And then I love that we can, when we name something, you know, maybe it sounds like we are normalizing, but we don't normalize so that we can then minimize. We normalize so that we can then elevate something to empathy, that I may not know exactly what that was like for you, and I have some idea. And that's where we, I think, can connect in even deeper ways.
I love that. I do think in sharing my story and in hearing other people's stories, sometimes it can feel really hopeless, especially in the immediate aftermath. But it's not. And I believe that we are designed to be resilient. It's in our makeup. And I believe that we're designed to grow. And one of the things that has helped me to metabolize this and other experiences and to grow is that I believe that there is good to be found in every experience, and believe that there's beauty to be found in the ashes. And even not knowing if God was real, I knew that if I'm going to be alive, I want a good life. and I need a good story to have a good life. And when I look at the past, I really can find evidences of God's hand, of goodness, of beauty in all of the experiences.
What's right, that different vantage point, right? It can be so breathtaking to turn around and see, oh, he's everywhere, right? But especially there's some that
and for
are
me,
extra
it didn't
poignant.
Come all at once. I had to go looking for it and had like to that. Gather the like evidence. That. And then the story emerged from the evidence, and I could see, wow, this was something that I was genetically predisposed to, and there were all of these angels and cushions around me to make this as soft as of an experience as it could have been.
Right. Yeah,
which it was not. It was not soft, but it didn't break me. So I could see where people were brought into my life who had specific experiences like this or stories that helped me on my path, where specifically a nutritional supplement that I've taken has helped me to be stable, has helped my body to be healthier now than it was when I was trying to conceive before. When we finally did try to get pregnant again, it happened like that. My body was much more healthy, and my pregnancy was really stable. The birth was really beautiful, and I have a very, very healthy little boy. And I can just see that. I think one of the stories that I had to address in my own mind was that if I'm doing everything that I can, that I will be protected from really bad things or hard things happening. And that's not the case.
Isn't that a fun idea though?
I know, like
that,
right?
One. I think we all like that one.
Great. We could earn a certain level of protection.
My checklist, I'm good.
But it's more that God will be with us, and we will see God with us. At some point, even if we don't at all the points. And that, again, everything can be made good. So I have asked myself, you know, throughout the journey, why would God let this happen to me? You know, and at some points that's been a question of despair and desperation. And then that's also just been a genuine question of why would God let me have this experience. And I believe that God would let me have this experience for a lot of reasons, one of which being if my foundational understanding of God was somehow not going to hold up to the weight of life and experiences, then maybe we'd need to get down in there and excavate on the very dirt level and rebuild from there. And one of those things that I believe needed to be rebuilt was this foundation of love. As kind of a person as I thought I was, and as loving of a person as I thought I was before, there is a deeper love that I feel now. And I'm sure it can go even deeper and hopefully will throughout my life. But that foundation of shared humanity, there's no inside, outside, us, them. It is just all of us, brothers, sisters, family members. And also, you know, other gifts were, my health has been more than restored. As I mentioned, I'm healthier now than I was before. And I'm grateful for that, for the kind of mother that I can be, and the things that I get to teach my son Will, and the place that I've been able to create. So that's the thing I'd love to share now is there's a story in my family history. We have a village where many generations of my ancestors lived. My great-great-grandma Maria, who immigrated to the United States, came from this tiny little village on the border of Hungary and Austria. Mm. And during a time of war, this village was claimed by one country, and then it was overtaken and it was claimed by another country. And so it was right in the heat of the battle. And the miracle was in the compassion of the people in this village. They looked on either side of them and they did not see countries and they didn't see us and them. They saw family, friends, and neighbors. And they said, it does not matter what side you are on. Our village is a safe space. Anyone can come here and be safe, can have a place to live, can have food to eat, can have work. You can come and belong here. And they identified themselves as a village without borders.
Mm. Love that.
And that story, I had the chance to go to that and some of the other nearby villages, but I had a chance to walk through the vineyards there and sit under a tree that would have been there when my great-great-grandma was there next to the church, and like dig my feet into the soil, which was extremely healing and profound. And hear this story firsthand from a woman who herself had come from another country and been taken in, and that this is a continuing legacy for this village.
What is the name of the village? Can I ask?
I was so inspired. So cool. And so Andy and I, we have taken that on as a part of our family legacy that we are continuing. And our home is a village without borders. Mm. And it's been incredible to share that story with family, friends, and neighbors who come into our home and who find themselves in the midst of divide, whether it's, you know, divorce or change in religious affiliation, or, you know, if they are feeling outcast for their sexual orientation, or just any other sense of being divided, that they can come and belong in our home. Yeah. And it's as good for us as I think it is for them. And it's something that I believe and know from my experiences that we are stronger and we are better from sharing the parts of us that we're afraid that people won't accept because it's different. But those things are actually strengths. And they, even though sometimes there is a tension that can arise in differences, that ultimately, if we can learn how to hold that tension and hold each other in that space, we end up coming up with the most incredible outcomes that one person alone could not have come up with on their own. We create incredible things that one person alone could not have created, or one way of thinking could not have created. And I think if we hope to expand ourselves as individuals and expand our community as a church, as a world, then we need to learn how to hold that space and hold each other in that space.
That is such a beautiful way to kind of conclude where your journey brought you, and where you were so divided within yourself, really. And then having to tolerate, even when you're talking about like the exposure therapy, right, of the dissonance and pain of sitting in a parking lot looking at the temple, right? How divided you felt inside. And then what you're describing now, to where, you know, relationship is the safe space. It doesn't have to be physical. It is relation. It's all relational. Yeah. And that idea of going from, you know, feeling so isolated, so alone and confused, to not only experience and belonging, but recognizing that the potential that each one of us has to offer that to those around us, even though we don't have to have consensus, we don't have to have identical experiences. None of that is necessary for us to experience that unity, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to share, if there is anyone who is currently feeling alone in their journey, to look for God and trust that even if you can't see, God is there. God is in the story. And I don't know what the exact outcome will look like, but I know that it will be something where we're together, where there's wholeness and love.
Stacy, what would you share or offer to any listeners who are finding that this, what you've described, resonates deeply with what their lived experience is right now? Who are maybe feeling hopeless or lack of resilience, or don't even know if trusting is a good idea, things like that. What would you like to say for them?
I would say you've got to do the work of gathering scraps. Look for the evidences of goodness in your life, the kindness of people who've showed up, the words that have reached you at just the right moment, the little glimpses that you've caught of heaven, of love, of belonging, and write those down, and you will see a story emerge, a bigger story. I have complete confidence that every single one of us is part of a story of love. And that this in this story, we need each other. and we're meant to be in this together. And that ultimately, I think, we'll find God in our love for each other.
I love that. One of the things you said right at the beginning that I wrote down that I loved, you said that the vast majority of people in this world are good. And I was really struck listening to your, you describe your experiences and really so many trials, so much trauma, and how absent your story is of any kind of bitterness, and that unfortunately can sometimes hang around after people have, you know, suffered in such profound ways. Can you talk about that? What helps you or helped you not maybe sink into that space?
I don't think that healing is, well, we know healing doesn't happen in a moment. It's a lot, a lot of little moments. And just like for me, when those suicidal thoughts were swarming around like gnats and I had to just choose to redirect, I think it's similar in that our stories can become really bitter and heavy when they're really deeply trying. And it does take just a constant and consistent, sometimes, effort to redirect and to redirect back to your grounding place. If there's something good that you believe in, that for you goes beyond question, and you can keep coming back to that point of safety, goodness, and trust.
I love that, that point of safety and goodness and trust. Yeah. Yeah. I was also kind of struck by the image of, at least that my brain came up with, of trying to hang the picture and how I think we just all feel that way sometimes, right? And I know clearly in your story, it was representative of something unique to what you were going through with you know, diagnostically and clinically. But this idea of, I am trying so hard to hang this picture and I cannot get it straight. And how humbling that can be. But I think maybe also one of those moments where, I mean, I think it takes two people to hang a picture. So, you know, something along those lines too, of we do a better job when it's not just us and when we don't fear that it needs to be.
So something I touched on early on, where I said that overall my faith and religious community have enriched my life, and kind of talking about that my, let's see, where was it? It was really coming to appreciate the organization of the church. I didn't have that for a long time. Mm-hmm. That's been a more recent realization. As I've continued on this journey, I continue uncovering these really valuable gems. And it's taken hindsight to see, wow, in my life that was so fragmented, this was an anchor place for me. And it took me to a place of appreciation where I think it can be really easy to criticize and to feel really negative about certain elements in the organization of the church or church culture. It can be a really tricky thing to navigate right now, especially. And I was able to look back and say, with like just genuinely, I'm so grateful that this exists. And as imperfect as it is incredible. It really is incredible that we have this network and these communities that we are a part of. And rather than, you know, hating the community or walking away from the community, which maybe we need to do in some cases, but just to say, what can we do to clean up a little bit around here? How can we make this more comfortable? How can we make this better? Because I really believe it is by divine design that we're organized into these communities and we're part of this larger community. It's my husband, Andy, is in a PhD program studying health psychology and the impact of our social relationships on health. Mm. And we're becoming more and more aware on a scientific level that we need each other. And I just think how inspired was this organization when we're lacking community in so many other ways. Religion is still one way that we can find that, and especially as members of the church, we have that built in anywhere we go in the entire world.
I love that. Yes, it is. Anywhere we go, there's that continuity and of community, definitely. And I would say, you know, what I see and hear a lot about is that when that community does, sometimes this can be the source of pain, it tends to be when there are lines of us and them within the community. And, you know, Christ says, if ye are not one, ye are not mine. And I think there's a lot to think about with that.
Yeah, the last thing I would say, I would love to connect with anyone who's interested in sharing their story. If you have more questions about my story, if you or a family member has been in a similar situation, please feel free to reach out.
Listeners, thank you for being with us. I have such a strong testimony that stories are sacred, and I'm really, really grateful for Stacy for being so open to describing with such in such an unapologetic and I think articulate way what she has been through. And I just have such deep admiration and gratitude to you for that. Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for joining us for this episode of Listen, Learn, and Love.